Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 79 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the first of a two-part interview, the journalist, non-fiction writer and novelist Marcel Bernstein speaks with Carol Angier about the golden era of newspaper interviewing, her early career in journalism, and her first book, Nuns.
Marcel Bernstein is a novelist, non-fiction writer, and journalist. Her newspaper life began on the Guardian Woman's page, then the Daily Mirror news desk. For 7 years, she profiled musicians, artists, and actors for The Observer magazine. Her in-depth interviews included, for example, Agatha Christie and Jean Rhys. For book research, she lived with French women prisoners, Mexican farm workers, and in American ghettos. The Times called her first non-fiction book, Nuns, a marvelous book. Many novels followed. Sadie won an Arts Council Best First Novel Award. Body and Soul became a television drama series starring Kirsten Scott Thomas as an enclosed nun and won a Silver Bear in Berlin and a BAFTA nomination. Like Nuns and Sadie, this book made the bestseller list. Sacred and Profane was filmed with Gérard Depardieu and Elodie Boucher as Le Pacte du Silence. Marcel's journalism has appeared in major newspapers and magazines worldwide, including The Times, Guardian, and Washington Post, and she continues to publish interviews today. Her books are translated into 23 languages. She's currently writing about Chagall and his lover. Marcel has discussed her work on TV and radio, spoken on writing at festivals and in schools, and led workshops. A Royal Literary Fund Fellow for 4 years at the University of Greenwich, she also taught creative writing and media there. She's currently tutor of the narrative non-fiction course at City University London. She's married to the investigative journalist and author Eric Clarke. They have 3 daughters and 2 grandchildren and live in Docklands. Marcel.
Hello.
You started with a fascinating career in journalism, especially as an interviewer of extraordinary people, not just Agatha Christie and Jean Rhys, but also, for example, Elizabeth Frink, Dusty Springfield, Stephen Polyakov. So the first thing I want to know is how you got into journalism in the first place, and especially into that branch of it. So, first of all, how did you begin?
Would you believe as a temporary typist on The Guardian? Classic entrance. I've been to Manchester College of Commerce because my family said I didn't need to go to university because I'm a Jewish girl and I'll be getting married and having babies. So my brother went and I did not. So I learnt very badly to type, although it has been very useful ever since, and I learnt even worse shorthand. And I had several jobs as a temporary typist, and then I was lucky I got sent to The Guardian and I worked for Mary Stott, the woman's page editor then, the famous woman's page editor. And she kept me on for a very long time. And I worked for her, which was a revelation. I mean, she was a marvellous woman. She mentored me. If I have a mentor, it was Mary Stott. Thank you, Mary. And she gave me a wonderful reference. And the reference took me to the Daily Mirror news desk in Mark Lane in Manchester, It was an assistant job. I did things like make out lists of journalists, reporters who were going to be on call. I did the daily news list for the things that were going to be covered. But I learnt a lot about journalism and I fell in love. I mean, it was the most exciting few months of my life. It really was fantastic. And then my mother decided to move to London and I followed her. And I'd already applied for a job on the Observer Colour magazine. I'd done this ages ago. And been turned down. So I went to see Nat Soper, who in those days I thought was a man, Nat Soper being the union. But I went to see Nat Soper and the guy said to me, there's a job at the Observer. And I said, no, there's no point in my going now. I've already applied and they turned me down. He said, no, you go along. I'll fix it. So I went along and I saw the managing editor and then he said, I'll bring Anthony Sampson in to see you. And I said, the Anthony Sampson? And he said, yes. So Anthony was duly summoned. And in the pause between Anthony coming in to see me and his actually arriving, I looked on the desk where there was my original letter written by me however many months before, saying I did this and I did this with my Manchester address on it. And across it, in what I later learned was Anthony's hand, were the words, to North Country, I think. I have to say, he bless him, he gave me the job anyway. So I joined as a researcher. That was how I started. I started doing research. And I was good at it. I loved it. It was exciting. And the research got published. I did a piece on papoose baby carriers, which in those days were an absolute phenomenon. Everybody got terribly excited about them. I did a piece on Muslims making the Hajj, the traditional visit. And it took off from there. I was bylined and it began. I went on to a North Sea oil rig and I interviewed people there. I did North Sea fishermen. We did a big issue on the North Sea and I did a lot of the people involved. We did a big issue on whales and I went and interviewed people there. Cockle gatherers, things like that. A fantastic Welsh slate miner who had pneumoconiosis and kept greyhounds. And he said to me, and I've never forgotten it, he said to me, the spirit of the dogs is strong in the valleys. Absolutely wonderful. And I mean, it really, the excitement of going and hearing people talk like this, and then gradually it began to be more important interviews, I guess. Our editor then, John Thompson, had this interesting policy that if it was a man, he sent a woman, and if it was a woman, he sent a man to interview them. And there were a lot of interesting men around, and I was a, you know, nice leggy blonde, and I got the guys.
I wish I'd been there. Right, well, now, the first thing that I ever read by you was your interview of Jean Rees when she just won the W.H. Smith Prize after the publication of White Sargasso Sea. And it was one of the things that led to my writing my biography of her.
That is fabulous to hear.
So thank you,
myself. Creativity.
Many, many decades later, I thank you for that. Now, I'd love to hear your memories of that encounter.
Well, I didn't really know at that point who Jean Rees was. I mean, I'd read all her books before the interview. I'd got everything on my shelves. So I knew, and I knew that a lot of it was autobiographical. But at that time, Jean Rees was not the Jean Rees we know today. She was an interesting writer, but not that much had been written about her. So a lot of what we know today, partly because of what you've done, a lot of what we know today, like the death of the little boy, for instance, of her son, were not in the public domain at that time. And none of the bad stuff of her life, in fact, was. So I went to see Diana Rathill, and Diana said, yes, of course she'll see you, but you must write to her first. Because in Cheriton Fitzpaine, where she lived, in this poverty-stricken little house, it has to be said, she had no telephone. And the telephone number that is on her letters, many of which I still have, were that of her neighbour, the elderly farmer who used to drive her around. So I wrote to her. I'm from The Observer, and I'd love to come and interview. And she said, dear Miss Bernstein, yes, that would be fine. And she said, what sort of questions do you want to ask me? And I said, well, I'd like to talk about... I was quite interested in her background, in the Dominican background. I'd like to talk about that. And she said, oh, well, I could talk about that, I expect. Very uncertain. And I went down to see her, and it turned out to be the first of, I would think, about 15 visits. Because what would happen, she was then in her, early 70s? She would get very tired. We would talk. I would go there. I would stay in a hotel nearby. I would go in and see her. We would talk. I would sometimes take her out for lunch. That was what she really loved, being taken out for lunch. And by the early afternoon, she was tired and stopped making sense. So I would pack it up then. I would go away and we would write a couple more letters and then I would go back again. And in those days, the colour magazines had a great deal of money at their disposal. We were riding very high. So I was allowed the time and the money to do this. And so a strange friendship developed. It was lovely. But I was in my 20s. I was, you know, I had a lovely life going on at that time. There was this lonely elderly woman. It was a bizarre friendship. It was bizarre. But I would send her presents at Christmas. I remember giving her a Patricia Highsmith and a silk scarf. But it was a friendship that developed over quite a long time. So although the interview reads like a day spent with her, it was many, many days. She was a strange woman. There was a helplessness about her that was quite extraordinary. Every time I went, I had to show her how to work her record player. And every time I went back, she claimed she didn't know. And it was apparently an ongoing thing. I wasn't the only person who showed her how to work that record player. A red record player. She'd insisted on the colour. And everything that happened seemed somehow wrong. She'd gone to Crediton to buy a coat. And the only coat that fitted her was green. And so she'd bought it. And green was an unlucky colour. And things like that happened. She found a frog in the bath. Things that happened to Jean were always bad. That's got to be a mental attitude, hasn't it?
Absolutely mental attitude. I mean, she needed bad things to happen. And she needed to blame other people for them as much as possible. When I went to see her, we'd arranged the time incredibly carefully. But when I got there, she insisted that I was 2 hours, you know, too early. And I'd done her this terrible, you know, unkindness of arriving before time, and she wasn't ready. And of course, I mean, I hadn't, but she needed to feel that. It gave me an insight into her straight away.
Did you get over it? Did it recover?
Fortunately, she eventually, I thought she mightn't let me in. And she just, there's a little crack in the door, you know, when she peered through.
Yes,
but she did in the end let me in, and we did have, in the end, quite a lovely conversation, but...
Yes.
Still, it's wonderful that you met her so many times. I envy you, actually. So I wanted to ask you, apart from Jean Rees, whether you know other memorable encounters, other wonderful ones or terrible ones, possibly, in your interviewing career.
Well, now when I look back on them, they all seem to be rather enchanted. But is that the gorgeousness of looking back? I mean, I travelled all over Germany with Kenneth Clark and the team when they were making Civilization. I went all across Canada. I went to Bali and interviewed twin princes of the house of Puri Anjar. And they made me this delicious meal. And I'm not kosher, fortunately. And I said, oh, this is delicious chicken. And the princess said to me, it's fruit bat. Never quite got over that. So I did a lot of travelling, which was lovely. Some of the interviews, though, were figures who were interesting then, but now have become really interesting. Dusty Springfield, I suppose, is the one that I had an extraordinary time with. Again, took a very long time to do because she was very busy and all over the place. And I did find that going back and back to people and having a relationship does change the information that they give you. I mean, people then start to talk much more freely. They're much more interesting. And I was so lucky that I had the entree and the time at my disposal. I mean, nobody was breathing down my neck saying we need it now. And what was fascinating then was that people tended not to give you cut-off points. I mean, you went to interview them, and if they didn't want to talk about it, they would sort of skim over it. But you were never given a list and said, oh, you can't talk about this and you can't talk about that, which is what happens these days. People are much more controlled, I think.
I'm sure that this interviewing job is a sort of balancing act. And so, you know, for example, Lynn Barber is famous for doing tremendously challenging and critical interviews of people. Now, I don't think you never did that, but I'm wondering whether precisely you ever had difficult aspects of interviewees that you didn't use, or...
I think I would not have asked questions in areas where I felt people were unhappy. I mean, I never could have done the Lynn Barber thing, because I found that I do instinctively like most people. I'm intensely curious. I mean, I think if I have one overwhelming personality trait, I am really, really nosy. So I want to know things about them. And it's out of interest. I don't want to use things... I wouldn't want to use things against people. I would find it very hard. The only person I ever interviewed who I really, really disliked was V.S. Naipaul, who many people did dislike. And I disliked him so intensely, I couldn't write the piece. I never wrote the piece. He was rude, he was horrible to his wife in front of me, and I just thought, I just don't want to do this. And miraculously, I was allowed not to do it. You know, God bless the observer.
Everything that we're talking about, you know, comes back to that. You know, how blessed those days were, and how much people got out of it, not just you, but your readers. So it's such a shame that it can't happen anymore. Okay, so you published your first book in 1976.
Mm-hmm.
And as we've already heard, it was a non-fiction work called Nuns. Mm. It is a fantastic, comprehensive study of the history and practice of convents and the whole idea of becoming a nun. Where did this interest in nuns come from in a good Jewish girl like you?
Right, really simple answer. I was working for The Observer, and a friend of mine who was on it became editor of a magazine called Honey, which was quite big in its day. There were two really lovely magazines at that time. There was Honey and there was Nova. Nova was the cultural one. Honey was the downmarket one. And she asked me to do a series of interviews on organisations of women. So I did the Women's Army, which consisted of talking to a couple of very large majors with enormous bosoms and uniforms and ties and Elizabeth Arden pink cheeks and a lot of powder and tight curls. They could have been Prime Minister in another minute. Great women. I did the headmaster of Rodine Girls' School, headmaster at that time, who was not a very nice man, but interesting girls' school. And I did a convent. I did St. Mary the Virgin in Wantage, and they wore full habit, and they were the first people in this country ever to work professionally with drug addicts. They were the first people to recognise the need. So, I mean, really quite amazing. I think it might even have been the late 70s. And we talked about their clothes, because I was fascinated by the clothes. I mean, what did I know? As far as I knew, they never went to the lavatory and they had wheels under their skirts. I knew nothing about nuns. They were supposed to be ordinary, simple clothing. But in a French order, for instance, it was ordinary, simple French clothing of the 18th century. So they had to have special mother-of-pearl buttons, handmade, to fit the costumes that they wore. They had to be the precise thing. But they said to me, we buy our underwear in bulk from Marks and Spencer, you see. And I said, Marks and Spencer. And they shrieked with laughter and said, yes, St. Michael. So I guess you could say that what got me fascinated was their liquors. These are lovely women. And I can remember, Eric and I were living together at that point, we weren't married, I can remember waking him up in the middle of the night and said, my God, it's a book. It's not an article, it's a book. And it started like that. I was fascinated, I knew nothing. So the first thing I did, I went and I looked up nuns and convents in the Children's Encyclopedia. And I wrote my outline based solely on that. And it sold straight away to a publisher, to Collins.
Now, your account in Nuns is an extremely balanced and fair one. But it's more than balanced and fair in both directions, I feel. It's clear in the book that your own personal values are secular and humanist values, and there are some aspects of the convent system that you condemn, you know, like a very authoritative male hierarchy in which the nuns themselves have no say in the rules that dominate their lives. But there are also aspects, clearly, that attract you. The fact, for example, that something like the nun's habit or a ceremony or a daily routine has been unchanged for hundreds of years. And also the drama and symbolism of Catholic ritual. So the book benefits a very great deal from the tension in the point of view. And I presume that you feel this tug between repulsion and attraction. Is that true?
I think one of the interesting things is that when I was doing this book, we have to remember, it was long, long before all the shock horror stories have come out. But there was an undercurrent of it. I mean, I do remember very vividly going to a mother and child home in the East End. It was the Sisters of Mercy, ironically, I am sure. And they ran a mother and child home, and they had a girl with a newborn baby in a room that was just a partition in another room without even a window. And I remember being horror struck by this. But on the other hand, I'd gone into the enclosure that opens the book, the Carmelites in Llandovery, which sadly closed down now. And it was enchanting. I mean, these women obviously all loved each other. They lived a very close, very gentle, very reflective life. They gardened. They kept a small farm there. They were articulate, they were funny, they wanted me to sing Hebrew songs for them, of which I have a very limited repertoire, I can tell you, but it was very nice. So I think what I did find was there was an incredible tension between the parts that I loved which I suppose are the ritual, because it was new to me and it is fascinating and I do like the timelessness of it. And then other things would shock me. The missionaries, for instance, would shock me. They knew themselves, by the time I interviewed them, that a lot of their work had been bad, because they would go in and they would change the culture of the community. They would take away, for instance, initiation rites, but they wouldn't put anything really in its place. So you got girls being pregnant far too young. You got young men turning to drink. I mean, Christianity was what they were supposed to be putting in its place, but they didn't put ritual in its place. And every group needs ritual. The whole subject is full of contradictions. Some things really are excellent, and other things, because I looked at them from outside, unconditioned, I had no conditioning, and some things seemed to me to be very, very wrong.
Nuns believe that they are helping the world through prayer. And you report this with sympathy, and it's very moving, the sympathy that you have for them. But do you believe that you can help the world through prayer, that it is in some way a truly useful activity, in fact, the most helpful and useful you could do?
I wish I could, but I think I don't. I think what you need to make the world a better place is good people doing good things, taking books to where there are none, stopping FGM, stopping women in Nepal being used as pack animals 12 hours a day and giving birth where they fall. I mean, there's a lot to be done. I would like to think prayer helped. To be honest, I think prayer helps the person praying more than it helps the prayed for.
After Nuns, you moved on to fiction. We have had more interviews from you in recent years, I'm glad to say. So we've had Liza Minnelli and Terry Gilliam and others recently, but we've never had another non-fiction book from you. Why not?
Well, I turned to fiction for entirely practical reasons. Within 5 years, I had 3 babies. I couldn't get out so easily. I mean, it was as simple as that. It really was just a sheer, what do you do? I could have had childminders in and babysitters and nannies, but I probably couldn't have afforded them. But even if I could have afforded them, I don't think I'd have wanted to. I mean, I was very excited to have a baby. And fiction seemed the obvious way to go. So then I did one book. Having done one, I probably got pregnant again, and then so I did another. I mean, it literally happened because I was at home with babies, and I found I could do it, and I found I loved doing it. I think what I liked most was still the research. So back to your non-fiction. I do think they lie very close, actually, the two of them. When I wrote Nuns, the last chapter was about the death of a Cistercian nun. But I could not see it. It was only at that point, and they have since gone, one Cistercian convent in this country. And I spoke on the phone to the abbess, but she wouldn't let me go and visit them. They were too strict for that. So I can remember sitting at the kitchen table and writing down what happens when a nun dies, how they leave her alone for the soul to go gently, how they then stay beside her, how they bury her without any wrappings in the ground, how they kneel and knock with their knuckles on the ground and beg for mercy for their sister. I wrote all this, and it was a beautiful end to the book, 2 pages long, very short. So I'm ill, and Eric brings me home a novel to read, and he brings me Sidney Sheldon's Sands of Time. Sidney Sheldon is the 7th best-selling novelist in the world at that point. And I'm reading this book, and suddenly I think, what? And I read, word for word, my last chapter in Sidney Sheldon's novel, The Sands of Time. It's a book set initially in a convent. And he took my entire last chapter and used it word for word. And if you want proof that fiction and non-fiction are pretty much the same thing, there you have it. I sued. And I won.
Marcel Bernstein, thank you very much.
That was Marcel Bernstein in conversation with Carol Angier. You can find out more about Marcel on the RLF website, and you can hear the second part of this interview in episode 83. And that concludes episode 79, which was recorded by Carol Angier and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 80, novelist and non-fiction writer Caitlin Davies confronts every writer's dilemma in her audio diary, How, in a busy week, can she find enough time to write? We also feature two recent highlights from the Vox section of our website. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.